taking your lunch hour here to join us on what is a topic that affects all of us and all of our communities all the time. Has just a huge impact on neighborhoods and communities, on development costs, on housing affordability, on so many things. So this is a really great opportunity to engage this discussion together with some experts. My name is Mark Holland. I work with UDI on their educational program, and otherwise I'm a planning and development consultant and a professor at Vancouver Island University in planning and real estate development. I'd like to acknowledge here, wherever any of us are, we are on the ancestral territories of the roughly 200 First Nations in British Columbia. And we acknowledge that history. We acknowledge that cultural richness. We acknowledge what's happened in the past and our inheritance and the responsibilities that come from that in an era of reconciliation. I'd like to thank UDI for taking the lead on organizing this and similar programs. Most of the discussion that happens in building our communities often happens in a fairly contentious way on a parcel-by-parcel basis. And we rarely get to get around the table together to talk about issues that affect all of us and we all need to learn from experts on so we can make informed decisions regardless of what side of the table that we're on and what our interests are. So this is a really rare and exciting opportunity. And I thank UDI for their efforts on behalf of all of us to create these tables and bring folks together to be able to do this. We don't have some organizations here in BC, or at least they aren't as strong in many of these areas as some other organizations, or even areas like the United States and the Urban Land Institute that create these tables. So we've been trying to create those, all of us together, to learn from each other so that we can do the best that we can in the roles that we have on behalf of our communities. This one is our second one this year that UDI has created. The first one was on pro formas. I think a number of you participated in that one. We had a great session with Colliers as they took us down the rabbit hole of large spreadsheets and equations and functions and calculations and ratios and everything to figure out when a bank is prepared to lend your savings to some developer to build a building and what the risks and realities are. So that was a really, really useful and an excellent neutral discussion where we all kind of can learn about this. So this is the second one. I think many of us in our projects, I don't mind in my own work when I'm doing site planning, I have a big spreadsheet open on the square footage, different kinds of units, how many parking stalls are required, translating that into space, into how many floors of parking. You just got to run this thing, and at a certain point, the alarm bells start going off and go, I think we're going to have to stop there because that's too many cars to store, and that's getting really expensive. So this is a really, really key issue. In urban areas, our parking stalls will range in cost up to $80,000 a stall if we're down at, say, P3 or P4. Many of you may have caught the recent news item that came out from Burnaby. I'm not sure how many of you caught that. A 50-story building with 14 floors of underground parking, and staff were sitting down kind of, we maybe pull that back a bit. I mean, that's essentially a 75-100-foot hole in the ground. That's quite an interesting challenge to shore that up and make that work. And do we really need to build that much expensive parking if it's not going to be used? Which brings us to the discussion today, which is very interesting because here in the room with all of us here, Sarah Fowler here is from Tassus, which doesn't have underground parking, and others of you are from cities, which you have, again, many, many, many layers of them underneath large towers. So it'll be a very interesting discussion. We have staff and elected officials both on this discussion. So Watt is going to take us through, the team here from Watt are going to take us through fairly high level, introductory level on many of these issues, and then also get down into the weeds. They have a presentation that'll be 45 minutes to an hour or so. There's any number of questions that may come up as you go. What I would encourage you to do is either make a note of them, or if you like, you can type comments and questions into the chat box here, and I'll try and keep track of those. And then we're going to open the whole floor up as soon as they're done their presentation, and we'll get into a good discussion of questions and debates and queries around what the experts say, what their models say, what their data says, and advice they may have to all of us to deal with. So I'll just introduce these two folks. I've had the pleasure of knowing both of them for a while, especially Nadine, decades, and working with them on many projects. It's an amazing team that Watt has compiled here, and they've been very generous with our discussions with UDI and our education programs to come and continue to raise all of our knowledge about how to deal with parking. So So Tim is a senior transportation planner, and he's the planning lead with Watt Consulting Group here. He's based in Victoria, but he works on projects all across Western Canada. He's done a very long list of the kinds of things that transportation consultants do, and Tim has done pretty much all of it. He's particularly developed an expertise in a lot of the active transportation and new innovative dimensions of transportation for dealing with electric vehicles, electric bike infrastructure, streetscape design, car shares, etc. He's worked on over 250 projects in the last number of years. And one of the things I think all of us have really come to appreciate about Tim is he brings data. He's the first thing whenever I ask him to work on something, he's like, well, I'm not going to offer you a comment on that until I get some data. So he's always out there pulling real data from real projects as close to where any area is and ones that are directly applicable to the kinds of projects that are under discussion. So thank you, Tim, for joining us. Nadine is the Vice President of Transportation for Watt, so she's one of the leaders in the company. She's been at this for nearly 2.5 decades. Again, the scope of work that she covers pretty much is everything that a transportation consultant does. In addition, she's done quite a bit of fairly complex technological systems work in modeling transportation systems that pattern through large areas to inform community master plans and all kinds of different types of new developments and how they can impact existing neighborhoods. Many of us have benefited from Watt's expertise. They work for public sector folks on many different plans of transportation work, as well as for private sector projects. But rarely do all of us get a chance to be able to spend an hour and a half with them to really ask those questions that don't otherwise come up. I'll admit that many of us sort of have these relationships with our transportation and parking consultants, kind of going, I'm not actually sure what questions to ask, but please keep going because I need to learn as we go. So this is a really great opportunity for all of us to be neophytes in this room, ask questions, whatever question comes to mind, so that when we leave in 90 minutes, we're all that much more educated about this really critical issue that's changing rapidly in our communities and how we can best decide to do this. So I'm going to hand it with that. Nadine, Tim, I'm going to hand that over to you, and you can take it from here, and we'll have a good discussion session here on your group. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. I'm going to share my screen. There we go. Thank you to UDI and all of you for joining us. We're really excited to talk to you about parking with a purpose. So just a little bit of an overview. We're going to talk a little bit about the history of off-street parking requirements and how and why they came about, how they started to evolve, and then the current trends in off-street parking. We'll talk a little bit about curbside management or on-street facilities and parking. And lastly, we'll touch briefly on transportation demand management and how that relates to parking demand. So we just wanted to start with a couple of key terms that you might hear throughout the report and our presentation, and it can get a bit confusing.
We're still seeing the cover slide.
Oh, sorry, wrong one. Oh, sorry, there's the present overview. Sorry, scrolling on the wrong screen. Some terminology. Off-street and on-site are basically the same thing. We tend to typically call it off-street most of the time. That's the parking required on private developments or private property. We then also talk about on-street or off-site parking. That's the parking that is on the public right-of-way, usually adjacent to a curb. You'll also hear us talk about minimum and maximum parking requirements. The minimum is the least that someone has to build, but they could build more. And the maximum is they could build more up to that number, but no more than that. Just wanted to set things off in case it gets a little confusing. So diving into the history. So when did we start dealing with parking? And it was really around the 1950s that cities started creating parking bylaws to require developers of new properties to put parking on their sites. There were some updates you know, up until the 1970s and, you know, maybe into the early 80s, but a lot of them just kind of languished and they were rarely updated. They tended to borrow from each other, so you could look at, you know, adjacent communities and they may have identical rates. And the rationale for the rates or the requirements were sort of lost over time, particularly if someone borrowed from a neighbor who had borrowed from that neighbor. And so where did those rates come from? How were they determined? Was that the right amount of parking? All of the parking bylaws as well at this time were based on minimum. So you must provide X at least on your site, but if you want to build five times as much, go ahead. So sort of this unlimited amount of parking consideration. And the goal of those bylaws was to prevent on-street parking from becoming too overcrowded and to meet the on-site demand on the private property. So, you know, on-street parking was maybe getting a little busier, people wanted to preserve it, and so the idea was that developers had to start providing their own parking on-site. And so, yeah, so kind of redundant. If all the parking for land uses is provided on site, though, why do we need on street parking? So, just kind of want to have that little, you know, thought work, in people's minds. There's often confusion about who the parking on private property or off street is for. It's pretty much for everybody who comes there. So the residents and visitors. Residential buildings or even single family houses are expected to be accommodated on their property. And then for commercial, we always think the customers are accommodated, but it's also supposed to accommodate the employees. You know, the expectation isn't that all the parking at a mall is for customers. It is to accommodate those employees that need to work there as well. So how do we use the bylaws? Basically, we take every individual land use on a property. So if it is a mixed-use site, there could be multiple different parking requirements, and we would do them just like this here. So this building, residential building, that's what their parking requirement is. That's what their need is. Here's the office building. And so you can see that, you know, we don't look at them as combined. We always look at them separately. And the rates tended to focus on peak times of the year, days, or weeks. So this is an example at Christmas. You know, a lot of the commercial parking doesn't quite cover Christmas, but it covers, you know, this is probably a Boxing Day, but it covers Christmas. Well, Christmas is pretty different than a Thursday in May. In terms of the parking need. And so a lot of times parking lots would sit empty because they weren't the peak amount of parking. So many of you have probably heard of Donald Shoup. He came out with sort of a seminal article in the late 90s. And he said there were two key assumptions that people were making about parking. That the demand for parking does not depend on its price. So, you know, if you charge someone $200 or you charge them $10, that demand is going to stay the same, which we now know is not true, that pricing can affect the demand for parking, and that the supply of parking should not depend on its costs. So it shouldn't matter if that parking spot costs $10,000 or $100,000, you still need to provide it. But of course, what we found is that, you know, the more the parking costs, that's really increasing your development costs, particularly where it's bundled or it's included in the price. So whether it's a rental or owned or even at a office building, if you just pay it as part of your lease, you don't necessarily think about that parking as having a cost. And that's why people see parking as free. So, you know, when you go to a shopping mall, you think the parking is free, but it's not really free. It has a cost to it. And he also came up with the concept that it's more efficient for cities to price and manage on-street parking than it is for them to spend time micromanaging the off-street parking. So,
we Makes sense.
With that, we're going to move to the evolution of off-street parking, and I'm going to hand it over to Tim.
Great. Thanks so much, Nadine. So yeah, just as Nadine mentioned, you know, historically, these off-street parking requirements and minimum requirements were very kind of focused on just like static parking rates, not really reflecting the fact that parking is dynamic and parking rates should be dynamic. So over the years, especially in the 2000s, Donald Shoup and other researchers were saying that, you know, there's a lot of other factors here at play that really need to enter the conversation about parking demand and understanding parking demand, which in turn, of course, influence how parking rates would be set. So as an example, Watt had an opportunity to really sort of test that research or apply that research to best practices about parking demand by updating the City of Victoria's Schedule C, so the city's off-street parking requirements around 2016 to 2018. And really, it was a chance for us to align parking regulations with current trends and research that was out there. Updating the parking requirements with actual parking demand through extensive data, which I'll get into in the next few slides here, and really recognizing that, again, that parking is dynamic and it's subject to a lot of factors like location, geography, like tenure type, the number of units and bedrooms that are provided, for example. And this, and the map we've shown on the slide here is just showing how this is one of the outcomes from that Schedule C work, showing the final map here where the parking requirements in sort of the core part of Victoria and also in sort of blue shaded areas, so essentially require less parking, recognizing the fact that those areas have higher walkability, better access to transit, so on and so forth. But as you get further away from the core, the parking needs are higher, and therefore the parking requirements in Schedule C are higher. Next slide. So these adjustment factors or parking demand factors that I mentioned, you know, this really, a lot of municipalities, or some of the bigger urban centers, Toronto, Vancouver, Seattle, over the last 10, 15 years, we're finding that parking demand is really influenced by these factors. So tenure type, whether it's affordable housing, a condo strata unit, market rental, that tends to impact how much parking is needed. I.e. affordable housing units, for example, require a lot less parking. That was shown very clearly in their studies. Number of bedrooms, so as the unit size increased or the number of bedrooms increased, that tends to be correlated with higher parking demand. And then location. So areas that are more walkable, more transit friendly, tend to have less parking needs. So those factors were really critical. We wanted to think about them in the context of updating Schedule C by the City of Victoria, looking at multifamily in particular. Next slide. So this map here is showing, so it's part of the multifamily residential parking demand that we looked at as part of Schedule C. We had a very extensive data collection process where we looked at over 100 multifamily buildings from across the city, which amounted to over 5,000 units. We got ICBC vehicle ownership data, and vehicle ownership as a proxy for parking demand. As you can see on this map here, our sites included locations in downtown Victoria, Big West, a lot of the urban villages, and then other less dense neighborhoods. And this included, of course, a sample of market rental, condo sites, and also affordable housing sites. So really to test those parking demand factors that I just mentioned. Next slide. Maybe just backing up for a second, you know, why even, question, I'll just answer that right now, it's a question there just so it's clear, the red and the white, those are the different tenure types. So I think the red was condo buildings, or red is market rental, and the white are condo buildings. So why do we even consider these adjustment factors? I mean, really just recognizing that developments vary significantly. Development in downtown Victoria is different from a development in Fairfield, for example. And as a result, parking supply needs should be different. It provides an opportunity to developers to actually align parking demand with parking supply. It can provide an incentive for developers to build in downtown areas or in large urban villages, for example, where you might need less parking because there's good sustainable transportation choices available. It can decrease costs for developers, recognizing that the cost of parking has only increased over time, especially for underground parking. And of course, it encourages urban development, helps achieve various policy goals and objectives, and that's in all communities, broadly speaking. Next slide. going back to the data, so those 100 buildings that I mentioned, over 5,000 units that were included as part of our sample for multifamily residential as part of the Schedule C update, you can see here that what we found for condominiums, for example, the average, and this includes visitor parking, was 0.84 spaces per unit. And for apartments, it was 0.59 spaces per unit. And really, what's the take home there? Well, if you compare it to what the previous bylaw rates were, it's obviously significantly less than that. And those previous bylaw rates being high, again, like for the reasons Nadine mentioned, sort of the rates that were established at a certain time, static, it changed over time to reflect parking demand factors, like changing vehicle ownership needs, you know, more walkable neighborhoods, etc. So it really was illustrative of how there was such a misalignment between actual demand and vehicle ownership data compared to what the current bylaw rates were. Next slide. This last slide here on Victoria Schedule C update is just showing you sort of the outcome of that work. So again, very data-driven exercise, and what you see in this table here is showing this is the current requirement for condominiums, multifamily in Schedule C, where the parking rates vary by geographic area, core area, village center, other area, and also by unit size. So those smaller units requiring less parking compared to those larger units. And we took the same approach for market rental units as well. And this was so backed by the data, the extensive data, and also through a stakeholder consultation process where we had a number of focus groups. Next slide. So moving away from Victoria to Metro Vancouver, where in 2018 there was another comprehensive study that was done looking at apartments right across the region, so in more urban locations or urban municipalities to the more sort of suburban ones. And the study was really just trying to understand how does parking demand currently align with parking supply in those buildings. And this included a range of housing tenures and locations. What the study found was that parking supply generally exceeds the use of the demand across the region for both rental and strata buildings, really confirmed what we found in the Schedule C Victoria context. Apartments parking supply use is lower for buildings closer to frequent transit, no big surprises there. Parking demand was also associated with unit size. The bigger units required tend to have higher parking demand and needs. And that parking demand is also associated with housing tenure. So rental units requiring less parking or showing less parking demand compared to condo construction. Another study that was done, and again, these are all really just confirming and validating this idea that there are so many parking demand factors that have been historically overlooked in our parking requirements. So for Metro Boston, a very comprehensive study that was done involved 200 apartment buildings across the region, 20,000 units in the sample. And the study had one big finding, and it was that in a lot of these buildings, there is too much parking. These buildings were overparked, a huge amount of wasted money because that space is just basically sitting underutilized. And it runs, of course, counterproductive to a lot of those local municipality schools to increase sustainable transportation use, decrease the amount of parking provided, etc. If you go to the next slide, so really some really important findings from this research from that paper. Three factors are most strongly predictive of parking demand. You'll see there's some recurring themes here. Tenure type, the amount of parking provided, and transit connectivity. I'll speak to each of these in the next few slides here. Next slide. So starting off with affordability. So what this slide here is showing, just to be really clear, is that the authors found there was a negative correlation between affordability and parking demand. In other words, as the share of affordable housing units actually increased in their sample, parking demand would decrease. So it's very similar to what Metro Vancouver found and also our work in Victoria. Next slide. Job accessibility and parking demand. So this graph here is depicting the relationship between transit access to employment, so within 30 minutes, and parking demand. And what the graph is telling us is that as job accessibility increases, so if more jobs are accessible by transit within 30 minutes, parking demand per unit decreases because people are less reliant on their vehicles, and they can use transit to get to their most key flight destinations. Next slide. Parking supply and demand. This is a really, really important one that it comes up a lot in council meetings and other conversations as well. What it's showing here is parking supply and demand. And really what it's saying is that there's a correlation between how much parking is provided and what the parking demand is. So in other words, as more parking is supplied per unit, the more parking is demanded per unit. I.e. you build it and they will come. You provide a lot more parking, there tends to be higher demand and more people are driving. Intuitive finding, but has been shown clearly through empirical data, and we also have seen this in other jurisdictions as well. Next slide. So moving from some of the research over the last 10, 15 years and some of our work in Victoria to some current trends in off-street parking requirements. So where municipalities are going right now in terms of their current thinking on their off-street parking requirements. Before I get into that, though, it is worth mentioning to the group, just to be really clear about how sort of Watt is approaching these parking studies, because this relates to this whole conversation about current trends and how parking requirements are being changed. So we do a lot of site-specific parking studies. Of course, we also do parking studies for municipalities, but we undertake site-specific studies, usually to support a parking variance in any given community. And three guiding principles that we follow as part of that work are: one, parking demand is impacted by those demand factors that I spoke about for the last 10 minutes, and recognize that parking demand is dynamic. Two, the data really drives, or the data should drive, the findings to help combat what we're calling parking psychosis. So all the emotion that gets sort of sucked into these conversations about parking. We find the data, we need to use stick with the data and what the data tell us to understand how much parking is true, to really combat that parking psychosis. And then lastly, TDM, or transportation demand management, should always be a consideration to reduce parking, but more importantly, to provide choices, sustainable transportation options, which also aligns with a lot of municipalities' policy goals, objectives, that kind of thing. Next slide. This map here is just an example of, it's a development site in Swinehold, where we really want to highlight, when we approach these parking studies, we look at the surrounding transportation context, right, in terms of what's the cycling network like, what's transit access like for that particular site, what sort of destinations are within a 5, 10, 15 minute walk, and that goes back to the parking demand factors that we spoke about, and when we choose our representative sites, the sites that we're going to study to figure out how much parking demand is needed for any given site, we consider all of those factors in terms of access to walk, walks for walking, transit, so on and so forth. And just to be fully transparent about how we actually collect the data, because there's obviously some misperceptions about this in particular. You know, we and other consultants do parking observations and counting different uses at different times of day. So for commercial parking demand, typically it's the morning and the afternoon when there's higher peak for parking. It depends on what the commercial use is, of course. For residential, it's the evening. We use ICBC vehicle ownership data, which I spoke to earlier, and that was kind of a big data set for the Schedule C update in Victoria, and we use it extensively these days for our studies. It gives you, again, vehicle ownership data as a proxy for parking demand. Phone interviews, IT, parking generation manual, literature review. We have a combination of sources, a combination of ways to get at the best data possible to figure out how much parking is needed for a certain development. And lastly, you know, when we finish these parking studies, we often, as Nadine mentioned, we have a whole table and summary of here's your total parking demand for the site, but we don't really look at it as a whole. We don't really talk about the opportunities for sharing and how that can reduce parking demand. So this graph here is just showing you how, again, parking is dynamic, temporally, spatially, so on and so forth. You can see the multifamily, that dashed red line, you know, it's high in the morning before people go to work. Of course, with COVID, things have changed a little bit, but the point is that the parking demand for residential tends to be much lower during the day, and then it increases in the evening as people return. Whereas for commercial, like office retail, it's the reverse. People, the demand is higher during the day, and then the evening tends to be lower. And this really just goes to show that there's opportunities to to share that parking to provide for efficiencies, but also to provide less parking overall. And this diagram here, I think, helps illustrate this. On the left-hand side, you have business as usual, right? Residential parking during the day, it's pretty much empty because people are away. So all those stalls are vacant. For the office use, it's full or busier because people are at work. And on the right-hand side, if you consolidate that parking, recognizing that the parking demands peak at different times, you can provide a lot less parking to satisfy that demand. And this is something we do a lot in our own work, in our parking studies. And I think municipalities are catching on to this shared parking idea. There's some kind of parking requirements or offer reductions for shared parking. Next slide. So now just moving from some of that context around just how Watt's approach parking studies reflecting the research over the years to now what's happened. You talk about parking minimums and all the different problems with parking minimums. Reflecting the research, municipalities now are moving towards parking maximums, or they have been for several years now. And there's countless examples in North America of municipalities that have adopted parking maximums. Maximum usually has a minimum and a max. There's a range of parking. The maximum itself is put in place to ensure that parking supply is not excessive. And it's usually considered when sites are within a downtown area, proximity to transit, and applies usually to certain land uses, right? So that reflects those parking demand factors I spoke about. It's not usually universally applied. Next slide. So parking maximums, I already just
hey, Cheryl.
Very high level explanation. We can get into it in Q&A, but I think what's more